but didn't entirely eliminate the machines within it. I'd been forced to spend most of the next day scouting and sending out small spell beasts to make sure they'd gotten rid of Ansys. When it finished, Linarala shared her findings from what was now the Dukedom of the Western Isles. Their infiltration had gone without a hitch, though the two-day wait while she communicated their desire to her mother had been nerve-wracking for Elaine and the others. Aside from telling Linarala that they were welcome to take the writings, she also warned her daughter that Tyrion might not be entirely trustworthy. I would have loved to know precisely why she thought that, but a two-day conversation with a Shi'ar elder was roughly the equivalent of a minute or two of normal conversation. There just hadn't been time. Linarala did get the feeling we might find some clues to her mother's suspicion in the writings they'd recovered. I hoped so. I could use some good news. After they'd finished, I did my best to explain what had happened at Castle Cameron, though I hadn't been present for most of it. I assumed that Moira would get the rest of the story from Irene while they were together, and I didn't have the energy to worry about it. I was exhausted, not because of any great exertion, but simply because grief does that to a person. Shortly after that, I retired to the bedroom I shared with, the bedroom I used to share with Penny, and I curled up on the bed. I wanted to sleep, but I could smell the scent of her hair on the pillows. "Why did you leave me?" I moaned to the empty air, but of course there was no reply, nor would there be, ever again. At some point I slept, and when I opened my eyes again, Penny was staring down at me with sympathy. "You look terrible," she observed. "I've had a bad couple of days," I remarked. "You aren't the only one," she returned. "I think I got the worst of it." "Want to compare notes?" I said, with a hint of challenge in my voice. She laughed. "Sure." I had a good opener already planned. Tyrion showed up in court. The Queen made him a duke, and he's already turned some of the other nobles against me. Penny shook her finger from side to side. "That one doesn't count, since it applies equally to both of us. Your enemies are my enemies." "Oh, right," I said lamely. "How about this? I think the kids hate me now." "That does sound bad," said Penny, "but I'm fairly sure they're mad at me too." "I got in a fight with Rose." She gave me a look of disapproval. "Oh, Mort, why would you do that?" "She started it," I responded, feeling childish. Leaning over, she ruffled my hair with her hand. "I'm sure she'll forgive you. She always does. Sometimes I wish you were smarter, though." Something about her touch lifted my spirits, and I joked in return, "Sometimes I wish you were dumber." She growled at that, but I distracted her before she could retaliate. "Your turn. I got in a fight with Rose. Now tell me something bad that happened to you." Penny looked thoughtful for a moment. Then she reluctantly responded. "I got in a fight with one of those giant metal monsters."
"Just one?"
"Two, as a matter of fact," she said boldly.
I grinned. "I feel badly for them."
"Your turn," said Penny, laughing.
"I got in a fight with three of them," I boasted. "They're called tortoises, by the way."
My wife shook her head, causing her ponytail to bounce to either side. I loved watching the way the light reflected from it. "That doesn't count," she replied. "You won."
I sat up in bed and gave a mocking half-bow. "That's true. That fight was probably the best part of the day."
"Why is that?"
"Because I won. But you..."
My voice trailed off as I stared at her, remembering. I finished with a whisper.
"But you died."
Tears were streaming down my cheeks. Her face became sad.
"You shouldn't have remembered that."
And then she began to fade away.
"No!"
I grabbed for her, but there was nothing but emptiness within my arms. I'd woken, and I spent the first 15 minutes of the morning the same way I'd spent the last 15 minutes of the night before, screaming into my pillow as I sobbed hopelessly. Epilogue. A week after the attacks on Castle Cameron, I found myself standing in the courtyard, in approximately the same place where my wife had fought the tortoises. With the keep still in ruins, the final service to say goodbye to my dear Penny had to be held outside, but considering the size of the crowd that was present, it was probably for the better. Washbrook alone accounted for nearly 1,000 attendees, and that was just the locals. The Queen herself was in attendance, along with a considerable number of major and minor peers of the realm. Even King Nicholas of Gododdin and the newly crowned King Gerald of Dunbar were present. Nicholas, in particular, had always had a soft spot for my wife, ever since she'd saved his life from an assassin's blade many years before. It wasn't all for Penny, of course. Walter Prathian had already been laid to rest, but the memorial service included a portion for him, as well as the men and women who died in the recent attack. But in my heart, if I knew the truth, at least half the crowd wouldn't have been there if Penny weren't among the fallen. Speeches were given, and unlike some funerals I'd been to for notable figures, I knew for a fact that those who spoke were honestly grieving. I myself gave a short speech for Walter, but when it came to my wife, my throat closed, and the words refused to leave my lips. But the Queen spoke for Penny, as did King Nicholas and King Gerald, relaying their sincere gratitude for her service to each of them. My children were too distraught to take a turn in front of the crowd, but many others did so. I watched them and listened, but I still couldn't believe it was happening. Numb to everything, I found myself a silent witness to the greatest tragedy of my life. Until Rose Thornbear took her place to speak on her friend's behalf. As ever, she was the picture of an ideal lady, managing even to outshine the Queen despite her somber black dress. Her legendary self-control served her well as she calmly faced the crowd. And then she spoke.
The Countess de Cameron was my closest friend. Penelope was a second mother to my son, and...
Rose's voice stopped, and she appeared to be struggling as though she was choking. And then her facade crumbled. Her son, Graham, led her away, crying publicly. The only other time I could remember seeing her so undone by a funeral was when Dorian had died. Then my mother, Meredith Eldridge, stepped forward to say her goodbyes. She was old, frail, and uncomfortable in front of such a great press of people, but my mother's pride of spirit refused to allow that to stop her. The sound of her voice pierced my numb heart, and tears began to fall before she finished her first sentence.
Penelope Eleniel was my daughter-in-law, but I could not have been prouder of her if she were my own flesh and blood,
began Meredith.
I don't know much about courtly ways or great deeds. I come from common stock just as she did, but no one possessed a nobler spirit than did our dear Penny. Many of you knew her as the Countess de Cameron, and some of you knew her as a warrior. But while she excelled in those roles, what I loved her for was the care she showed to both my son and my grandchildren. There was no finer mother, no better wife to be found in this world. She cared for her family with a passion that knew no limits, protected them with a fierceness that couldn't be denied, and loved us with a heart that knew no bounds. I have thanked the stars for her every day since the day she chose my son to share her love with.
The rest of the day was a misery. A large dinner was held in honor of Penny and Walter, and since I had no facilities to host it, the Queen had offered up the palace for it. Once the funeral was over, the important figures were taken there via teleport circles. The worst part was that I was required to go with them. When royalty attended the funeral for your family, some acknowledgement was required, even if they didn't demand it from you themselves. I sat through a long dinner with Ariadne and the other notables, but I wanted nothing more than to run away, to hide myself somewhere where I could grieve in peace, unobserved. Ariadne understood this, and she did her best to keep my family's participation as short and painless as possible. My children escaped after less than an hour, and I made my excuses a half an hour after that. Consequently, I found myself walking alone down the long hall that led from the central portion of the palace to the front gate, and I was glad for the solitude. I had no idea where I was headed, and didn't really care. If I'd intended to go home, I would have made my way to the Queen's portal to my house.
Mordecai.
It was Rose. I hadn't spoken with her since that day in the throne room, not because I was angry, I'd gotten over that, but simply because I was hurting too much. Graham had been the one to notify her and the Queen about Penny's death. This was our first private moment in almost a week. I turned to her with dead eyes. Yeah. My cold response earned me a faint frown, but she pushed that aside.
How are you?
She asked. I'm fine.
Don't be like this, Mordecai. You were there for me when I lost Dorian. I know what you're going through.
I put as much sincerity into my words as I could as I interrupted her. I appreciate that, Rose. I just need time. Alone. I should have hugged her, thanked her, opened up, but I didn't have it in me. I felt dead inside. Without waiting for her to reply, I turned and started walking away.
Mordecai, she called, raising her voice. We need to talk. There are other things we can't ignore.
I turned back. Such as?
The Queen has requested my presence in the capital for an extended period due to the recent attack. I won't be able to return to Cameron for a while, she informed me.
Lady Rose was more formally known as Lady Hightower. Her hereditary duty as the Hightower was overseeing the Royal Guard and the defense of Albemarle. Given the recent attack, it made perfect sense she would need to spend time in the capital. But there was something more in her eyes as she told me that. I simply nodded, accepting her statement.
Given Tyrion's sudden entrance into politics, I think my presence here may be of more value to us anyway, she continued. Things are moving, and we need to understand his motivations better.
Us. What significance such a small word held. Us represented my small group of friends and family. Over the nearly 30 years I'd known Rose, us had changed a lot. Originally it had been me, Marcus, Penny, Dorian, and Rose. That had been us, our little faction, out to save the world. If I hadn't been deep in the throes of grief and depression, I might have admitted to myself that us now included a lot more people, like the Queen, our children, even Sion and Chad. But the shadow over my heart wasn't in the mood to be so magnanimous. Just then all I could see was that us had been steadily shrinking. All that was left of our original us was Mordecai and Rose, and Mordecai didn't want to play anymore. Us, I said angrily. There is no us. Rose flinched as I said it, and I knew why, but at that moment I didn't particularly care. I wanted to hurt someone. Us is gone. It disappeared when Penny died. Marcus is dead. Dorian is gone. There is no us anymore. Get over it. Move on. Your husband has been dead for over a decade now. Rose's face had gone pale at my words, and I would have said more, would have wounded her even more deeply. But from somewhere inside, a voice in my mind warned me.
That's enough, Mort. Don't you dare take your pain out on her.
Her shock didn't last long. Rose lifted her chin and glared at me.
I realize you're grieving, Mordecai, but that doesn't give you the right to say whatever you please.
I was already beginning to feel bad for lashing out at her, but I wasn't ready to let down my guard. You're right, as usual. Now if you'll excuse me, I'd like to be alone. She didn't try to stop me as I walked away this time. 3 days later, I was sitting at the edge of the forest, just beyond the cleared fields that surrounded what was left of Castle Cameron. A stranger might have thought I was enjoying the shade, but I wasn't really enjoying much of anything anymore. There were sheep in the field, grazing, part of my agreement with the local shepherds to keep the area around the castle clear. I watched them slowly cropping the grass without really seeing them at all.
This is where you've been the last few days.
It was Chad Grayson. He'd been quietly approaching through the forest. If it hadn't been for my mage sight, I never would have known he was there. What do you want?
I've been expecting you to show up at the Muddy Pig for the last 3 days to drown your sorrows. I didn't think to look for you out here, lusting after sheep. It's a little soon, don't you think?
He responded, ignoring my question.
No one asked you to look for me. Now that's no way to talk to a friend, grumbled Chad. And here I've been holding a seat for you at the tavern every night. You have no idea how much work it is getting drunk every night trying to console a fellow who ain't even there.
I gave him a surly stare. You know I avoid drinking too much. Chad grinned, pulling out a bottle of McDaniel's Finest.
I'm thinking times like this are when you need to lay your hair down, little girl.
I looked away from him, hiding my face. It was hard to avoid a smirk when faced with the hunter's infectious enthusiasm for the bottle in his hand. Getting drunk isn't an option for me.
Why is that?
You know why. If I get too drunk, things are liable to start breaking. Buildings, trees, innocent people, that sort of thing, I answered. Chad snorted.
There are no buildings out here, and them trees been giving me the eye for years. They deserve what they get.
There are people, I responded, and as I started talking to myself again. The hunter unstopped the bottle.
I'll grant you that one. There's people here, but no decent people, and for damn sure no innocent ones. I grunted, then accepted the bottle, trying not to choke as I took a long pull. That's true. I passed the bottle back to him so he could join me. We passed the bottle back and forth for a while, until the world took on fuzzy edges and my head began to swim. What happened with Tyrion that day, in the tavern? When I left, it looked like you were planning to get him blind drunk and leave him in a gutter somewhere. I didn't expect him to show up at the palace in Albemarle. I gave you a hard time, eh? I nodded. You could say that. So many things went wrong that day. I kind of felt like you let me down. Well, I'm a little embarrassed about it myself. I kept that mean bastard drinking until I figured he was about ready to pass out. And then he just up and walked out, sober as you please. Never seen anything like it, admitted the huntsman. Then I understood. I wouldn't have dreamed of using my abilities in such a dangerous fashion, not while drunk, but apparently Tyrion didn't mind taking risks. I must have reset his body to a sober state when he was ready to leave, I thought. Don't beat yourself up, I consoled him. I don't think he was fighting fair. Fucking wizards, swore Chad. Well, archmages, I silently corrected, but the distinction was academic for most people. I took another drink and then lay down in the grass. My balance seemed better closer to the ground. After a few minutes, Chad spoke again. I think your kids are worried about you. My decent man would grieve by getting drunk so he could be hung over at home during the day for his family. That line was so ridiculous I couldn't help but chuckle. I thought we already established there were no decent men here. Besides, that's your way of dealing with your problems. After a second, I added, did they send you looking for me? Chad sneered. Do I look like a fucking nanny? I tried to imagine the sort of family that would think of hiring Chad Grayson to watch their children and began laughing again. Chad laughed with me. That's what I thought. Then he added, I heard the Thornbears are moving out, heading back to the capital. Yeah. And that's all right with you? None of my business, I responded. Lady Hightower owes fealty directly to the crown, not to me. At least don't, countered the hunter. And Graham was knighted by... His words trailed off as he realized what he'd been about to say. Anyway, he owes fealty to you. What's your point? I growled. You think I should hold an old woman hostage to keep Lady Rose here, or Graham? It's not like I'm desperate for men-at-arms. You're such a fool sometimes, said Chad. Lady Rose leaves, takes her mother-in-law and son, and before long Graham will be asking to take service with the Queen. Next thing you know, when Alyssa's there with him, and when she goes, the Sion won't be far behind. How many people are you willing to give up? I'm a count, not a prison warden. Don't be an idiot. From what I heard, Tyrion and Gareth Galen are both spending a lot of time in the capital, making nice to the Queen, and neither one of them is particularly fond of you. Well, your own son Connell is the Queen's champion now. He'll probably be moving out too. I sobered up enough to give him a flat stare. We all serve the Queen, and Ariadne is my cousin. This isn't a war. We're all on the same side. Spoken like a true political genius, you dumb fuckwit, spat Chad. From anyone else, those words would have made me angry, but from Chad Grayson, it was more like a warm hug. I never claimed to be a political genius, and I don't give a damn about politics anyway, not anymore. What about your family? I glared at him. What does that mean? Think it through. Everyone starts leaving for the capital. Meanwhile, you're here, spreading cheer and joy wherever you go. How long before two of your other three kids find somewhere else to be? Before you know it, it's just you and Irene sitting around the fire together telling sad stories to one another about the good old days, explained the hunter. I think you're getting a little far afield with your speculation, I commented. And why Irene? 'Cause out of all of them, she's the only one that's as fucked up as you. That, and she's feeling guilty about her mother. She'll be the one to stay home to take care of her broken-down old daddy, if only out of a sense of duty, said Chad. I growled, watch your mouth, that's my daughter. First sensible thing you've said, remarked Chad. You almost sound like a father, but I'll be damned if what I said ain't the truth. Keep going like you are, and someday she'll be following you around, wiping the drool off your chin. What kind of miserable life is that for a girl? Then what do you suggest I do? I was getting annoyed by the constant lecturing. He cursed at me. Go tell Rose not to move to the capital, you slackwit! What did you think I was trying to tell you?
Oh, I said, somewhat stupidly. I thought you were saying I should start getting drunk in the tavern with you every night. Chad shrugged. Well, that too. There's a lot of people grieving right now. You might as well drink with them. I chuckled. You know, for all your abrasiveness, I can't help but think you're telling me all the same things my mother would say. Ha! Only if your mother was a drunken... He stopped suddenly when he saw the warning in my eyes. Well, you know what I mean. Staggering, I got to my feet and promptly tried to fall over. Chad caught me, lending me the use of his shoulder. He wasn't half as drunk as I was. I stumbled across the pasture, mainly due to my lack of coordination, while Chad helpfully pointed out sheep, giving them ridiculous names and making suggestions about which might keep me company in the future. I laughed and snickered along with him, and for the first time in a week and a half, I felt vaguely human. Drunk, true, but human. Now, what are you going to do when you get back to the castle? Asked Chad. Tell Rose to stay, I recited dutifully. Good. And after that? Get you a dragon, I said cheerfully. The hunter frowned. I don't think that's a good idea. Why not? I asked blearily. Chad patted my shoulder. Not sure you've noticed, my friend, but you're drunk. Whatever, I mumbled. I'm getting you one. You need a companion. Like a hole in my head, returned the hunter. Seriously, they're better than sheep, I told him with a snort. Trust me. He slipped, and we both wound up on our asses. After another laughing fit, he surrendered. Fine, I'll take a dragon. But what about after that? We tell Rose not to leave. We already said that, said Chad. After Rose and after the dragon, what'll you do tomorrow? I sat there for a moment, and then my voice grew more serious. I'll start reading the Shi'ar writings that Linarala brought back. I need to learn as much as I can if I'm going to stop Ansys and fix whatever the Shi'ar did to the world thousands of years ago. Chad grinned. I was hoping you'd say that. You knew about the Shi'ar writing sculptures. Now I was genuinely confused, since I was pretty sure I hadn't told anyone about them. No, said the ranger. I don't have a damn clue what you're talking about. I just wanted to hear you say something that sounded like you have a purpose. Oh, well, I guess I do, I agreed. Then he added something under his breath. It was hard to make out, but I could hear bitterness in his voice. It sounded as though he said, otherwise you'll wind up like me. I didn't know much about Chad Grayson's checkered past, but pondering the mystery brought another question to my mind. Hey, how long have you and Danny been so close? Chad growled at me. None of your damn business.
This is the end of Book 1, but the story continues with The Severed Realm, Book 2 of The Riven Gates. Keep listening after the credits for a free preview. If you enjoyed this audiobook, find more just like it by visiting audfans.com, the premier audiobook discovery service that brings tailored recommendations direct to your email. That's audfans.com. You've been listening to Mordecai. Book 1 of The Riven Gates, produced by Emily Durr, executive producer Greg Lawrence, written by Michael G. Manning, performed by Alex Windham. Text copyright 2018 by Michael G. Manning, production copyright 2018 by Podium Publishing, all rights reserved. Chapter 1.
It had been more than 2 weeks since the funeral, and despite Chad Grayson and his liquid encouragement, I hadn't done much. Most of the Thornbear family had moved to Albemarle and were now staying in the Hightower residence within the city's massive bailey. Only Graham Thornbear remained in Cameron, but as Chad had predicted, I had my suspicions he might be considering asking me to release him from my service. Graham's fiancée, Melissa, was still working for me as maid, but her probation would end soon, and I had no doubt she would follow Graham wherever he went. I'd intended to talk to Rose before the move, to apologize, but she'd been gone before I'd recovered from Chad's counseling. My family were still in mourning for their mother, but my youngest, Irene, seemed to be taking it the hardest. She still felt responsible for her failure to save Penny from the monsters that had wounded her, and it didn't help that her closest friend, Clarissa Thornbear, had moved away. Chad and Cyan both had dragons now, but I saw very little of them. They'd taken to the wilderness, ostensibly to patrol, but I had a feeling they were up to more than that. My intuition told me that Cyan was probably helping the hunter adjust to his dragon bond. Cyan had never had a dragon before either, but he had had an earth bond once, so he was already acquainted with the difficulties that came with having extreme physical strength. Matthew had been keeping himself locked away, losing himself in whatever project he was currently working on. I hadn't spoken more than a couple of sentences to him since Penny's death. It made it clear that he held me responsible for Penny's death, and the wound was too fresh for me to approach him. I would have worried more about him, but Karen kept a good eye on him. She was still traveling, expanding her horizons during the day, but she stayed with us in the evenings. More specifically, she slept in his room. I wasn't sure how Penny would have felt about that. We'd both worried he might never find someone, and my wife had liked Karen, but she might have balked at allowing them to be so intimate without some sort of official betrothal. Moira had spent the first week after the funeral in her room, refusing to engage with anyone. But after that, she'd come to some sort of decision. I wished I knew what it was. She'd left for the city of Hallam. I thought she might be helping her friend Gerald, the new king of Dunbar, but I had no real idea. My youngest son, Connell, now Sir Connell, was in Albemarle. Of all my children, I thought perhaps he blamed me the least, but he was hiding from himself. He'd been named the Queen's Champion for his service, saving her life during a recent assassination attempt, and as a result was a minor celebrity among the members of the Queen's court. As a younger son and a middle child, he probably welcomed the attention brought on by his newfound fame. Irene kept herself busy with Castle Cameron, and her resolve served to keep the people organized and motivated. She spent most of her days there, using her power to assist in the removal of tons of stone rubble that stood in the way of rebuilding our ancestral home. They'd finished clearing the last of it yesterday, and now she was moving on to the outer wall, which had also been partly demolished. The obvious conclusion one could draw from all of this was that I was a terrible father. If someone had said that to me a few weeks ago, I would have argued with them, but now I was inclined to agree. Penny had been the glue that held our family together. That was painfully apparent now that she was gone. If I had been a good parent, it was only because of her influence. Today would be different, though. I'd spent the last few days consulting my memories of what Castle Cameron had been like previously and sketching new plans. The new keep would be larger and stronger with a better layout. The old one had been originally constructed over 300 years ago, and later owners had added to it and remodeled parts, resulting in a somewhat chaotic floor plan. Building a castle, or even just rebuilding one, was an undertaking that would ordinarily consume years and thousands upon thousands of hours of labor. Building the keep I'd planned would be impossible if it were left to traditional techniques and stonemasonry. But I didn't plan to build it. I wanted to try something new. I would grow it. I couldn't help but remember something I'd once been told by the shade of Moira Sentir.
Listen to me, son of Eluniel, and I will tell you what I learned at great cost once, long ago, ages before you were born. The ability to destroy is the least form of power, though it is the first form that any power will take. Even an infant is able to destroy things, weak though it may be. Using your talent to build, to create, or to restore, those are the greater forms of power, and those forms require time and cultivation to mature.
I had later helped her to regain some of her humanity, giving her a body of flesh and blood, and she was now married to Gareth Galen. Unfortunately, she and I were no longer friends, but I still treasured what she'd taught me. My life might have turned out better if I'd paid closer attention to that particular bit of wisdom. For example, if I'd spent more time finishing Penny's armor instead of running off to destroy Ansys. Today, I would create something new, build something stronger than what I'd allowed to be destroyed.
Are you sure about this, Dad?
Asked Irene, looking up at me worriedly.
I've never been your Mealt before.
The word Mealt meant watcher, and it was the traditional term for a wizard tasked with keeping an archmage from losing his mind while using metamagic. I'd used my gift without taking such precautions too many times to count, but there was no reason for me to take risks when help was at hand. You'll be fine, I told her. Just watch me, and if I seem to be drifting too far, talk to me. Our minds will be linked, so I will hear your thoughts no matter what. You remember the spells I taught you? She nodded, and then added,
but I've only been a mage for a few weeks.
Doesn't matter, I replied. Being a Mealt isn't a job that requires a lot of skill. The most important thing is the relationship between the Archmage and the person acting as Mealt. Being my daughter makes you almost perfect for the task.
Why?
Because I love you. It will make the connection stronger. No matter how lost I become, I'm less likely to ignore your warnings, I answered calmly. I could see the fear in her eyes, the self-doubt. She'd lost her mother, and now she feared losing me as well. If I did screw this up, she would be far worse off, but my hope was that if we succeeded, she would regain some of her confidence. Are we ready? I asked. Irene's eyes unfocused for a moment as she used her mage sight to search our surroundings once more.
The courtyard is clear, she answered.
Taking her hand in mine, I linked my mind with hers and then turned my thoughts inward, opening the gates of perception and letting the voices of the world seep into my soul. Within me, etched with crystalline perfection, were the plans I'd laid out for the new keep. Ignoring all the other voices, I focused on the drumbeat of the earth, absorbing it, making it mine. My awareness expanded, sinking into the ground. To accomplish what I wanted would require delicacy and precision. Deep below the castle was the Ironheart Chamber, the prison trap I'd once used to trap Caranth, the god of justice. Much of his power was still contained there, and it was important that I not allow the work I was doing now to disturb it. If the enchantment was damaged, it might explode, destroying not just my castle, but the entire region. Farther down was the molten sea that would provide the raw materials for my new castle, but that sea wasn't yet suitable. I made it a part of myself, and then began to draw it up, filtering it with the knowledge contained in the frail flesh-and-blood brain that stood on the surface. Iron, nickel, copper, these were the things I could use. The ground began to shake, evidence of a lack of control. Smoothing the rough edges of my mind, I brought the shaking to a stop. I had to be fluid, flawless and perfect as I poured the blood of the earth into the shapes I desired. Irene stood beside her father, feeling small. She wasn't particularly short for a girl of her age, but standing next to him made her feel diminutive. Once the bond between their minds formed, she felt better, safer, but that illusion vanished quickly as his mind grew distant, changing into something alien. She saw it all through his eyes, but being human, much of it was incomprehensible to her. Her father's hand grew hot, so hot it began to burn her skin, and she gasped when she turned her eyes on him and saw that his body was changing, turning to stone. It forewarned her of this, so she chanted a quick spell to protect herself from the searing heat. The ground trembled for a minute or two before becoming still again, and then she saw a blazing white fountain erupt from the center of where the keep had once stood. It sizzled as it came into contact with the air, throwing sparks in all directions and filling the air with an acrid odor. Irene chanted another spell, building a shield that would not only protect her from stray sparks, but also filter the air and keep it clean enough to breathe. Her father's mind was nearly gone. The stone statue standing beside her was merely a remnant. It contained only the tiniest amount of whatever it was he'd become. But she clung to it, not just with her hand, but with her heart and mind.
I'm still here, Father. Don't forget me.
There was no response, but the glowing fountain of liquid metal rose higher, climbing into the air like a golden serpent. It snaked back and forth, and parts of it began to solidify into reddish-orange metal shapes. More continued to pour forth from the earth as the bones of a massive structure slowly formed in front of her. Minutes passed into hours as it grew into a towering construction of heat and metal. She grew tired and her legs grew weak. As the day wore on, she sank to her knees, still holding onto the statue and wishing she'd thought to pee before they'd started. Eventually, the metal stopped, and a crackling sound filled the air as a new substance emerged. This new substance was a bright orange, flecked with black, liquid stone. It flowed up and around the metal framework and filled the spaces in between. The sun gradually dropped below the horizon while the keep continued to take shape. The moon was high in the sky when the stone portion was finished, and Irene felt certain they were almost done. But it wasn't over. She wanted to cry when sand and soil began to rise from a dozen points around the new keep, flowing in to smother the burning rock.
Father, I'm tired. I can't keep this up. She entreated him silently.
But again, there was no response. The sand and earth buried everything, but it didn't stay still. It moved, shifting and pressing on the leviathan of stone beneath it. The moon set, and darkness covered the world, but her inhuman father's work went on ceaselessly. At some point, Myrene's desire to relieve herself had disappeared, gradually replaced by sensations of thirst and hunger. Something was wrong. She knew it. It shouldn't have taken this long. She still felt the presence of a strange intellect in the stone, but she couldn't say for certain that it was her father anymore. If he was gone, it was her fault. It had been her job to keep him anchored to his humanity. Dawn had come by the time the sand started receding, disappearing into the earth, leaving behind a gleaming black edifice. It hardly mattered to Irene. Sitting on the ground next to the pillar of stone that had once been her father, she felt hopeless. Her arm was numb and aching from being held raised over her head for hours. But the real pain was in her heart. She'd failed.
Mum, I'm sorry. I couldn't do it. Now he's gone too.
The world went silent as she bowed her head and closed her eyes. After a time, she lapsed into unconsciousness. Sometime later, someone found her. Irene felt herself lifted, cradled in strong arms. Long hair tickled her face, and when she opened her eyes, she finally understood.
I'm dreaming.
Her mother was carrying her, a look of concern on her face. Irene stared up at her, thinking,
if this is a dream, let me stay asleep a while longer.
Eventually, Penny stopped and knelt, setting Irene down on a cold stone floor.
Sorry, sweetheart. I wanted to take you home, but I couldn't find the way. It looks like the old entrance is gone. The keep is completely changed. Rest here until your father returns. I lost him, Mum. He can't come back, said Irene sadly. I lost both of you.
Don't be silly, said Penny, stroking her daughter's hair. He'll be back, I promise you. You did well.
This is just a dream, isn't it?
Said Irene. Penny nodded.
Yes, but sometimes dreams are just as important as the real world.
She sat down next to her daughter.
Have you eaten?
Irene shook her head.
No.
Her mother scowled and then sighed.
Your father. I'd love to give him a stern talking to right now. Tell him I said he'd better take better care of you.
Irene sniffed, trying not to cry.
He's not doing so well, Mum. Things aren't the same since you...
Shh.
I know. But he still needs to snap out of it. He has a lot of people to help him if he would let them. What are your brothers and sisters doing?
Irene started talking, giving her mother a summary of what had been happening, describing the distance that had grown between her siblings. The more she talked, the more agitated her mother became. Eventually, Penny stopped her.
So they've just dumped everything on you? That isn't right. The oldest should be the one to step up first. Well, Matthew is... I know exactly how he is, but what about Moira?
Penny paused and then growled softly to herself. Then she spoke again.
I know what you need to do. What?
Asked Irene, hopeful again.
Talk to Rose. She knows how to handle them, and she has more than enough spine to slap your father into shape, said Penny. She's gone, said Irene, tears welling again. They got into an argument, I think. She moved back to Albemarle with Carissa and Elise.
Penny looked thoughtful. They told me they had a fight, but I didn't think it was that serious.
You need to go to the capital, then. Talk to her, explain things, just as you did with me. She'll understand. I don't think so, Mum. She won't listen to me.
Then tell her I said it. If she doesn't fix it, then I'll haunt her, snapped Penny.
But this is a dream. I can't...
Penny put a finger over her daughter's lips.
I already told you. Sometimes dreams are more important than what we think is real. Trust me.
After that, she held her daughter, the two of them leaning against the cold stone wall, until Irene drifted off again. Chapter 2 I woke up cold, stiff, and sore. My right arm had gone to sleep, and my back was explaining to the rest of me that it wasn't going to take this sort of treatment anymore. Glancing around, I realized I was in the Bailey. How the hell did I get here? My last good memory was of the construction of the castle. I'd gone deep into the mind of the earth, too deep, perhaps. Usually I could at least recall the return, but this time it was just a blank after a certain point. Irene was leaning against me. Had she brought us here after I finished? It bothered me that I didn't know. I tried to ease out from under her, but as soon as I moved, she groaned and opened her eyes.
Dad?
Yeah, it's me, I told her. Did it turn out like I planned?
I'm not sure.
How did we wind up in the Bailey? I asked. She frowned.
I had a strange dream.
I grinned at her. So you dreamed us here? Irene shook her head.
I don't think so. I was carried. That was you, right?
I shrugged. Maybe. I get really weird when I go that deep. I don't remember much. Let's go home. The heat radiating from the new keep engulfed us as soon as we left the Bailey. It felt similar to being in an oven, or at least as I imagined it would feel if I were ever inside an oven. That was one of the few forms of torture I hadn't been subjected to yet. Give it time, I thought. Sooner or later, someone will find a way to remedy that gap in my education. We hurried into the transfer house and took the newest circle back to our hidden home in the mountains. Linarala found us within moments of entering the house.
Welcome home, said the Shi'ar girl.
There was something odd about her appearance, but it took me a moment to figure out what it was. Linarala, why are you wearing an apron?
It seemed prudent to wear the proper protective gear for the task, she answered.
A more thorough inspection revealed that the ends of her long silver tresses were stained and stuck together with a mysterious brown substance. Adding that to my available information, including the strange smell in the air, I came to the obvious conclusion. Have you been cooking? The smile she put on her face was so awkward that it made me shiver.
Yes, I started yesterday, but you never returned, and Matthew and Moira never appeared either. I was forced to throw it out, which may be for the best. I don't think it was very good.
Where was Alyssa? I asked, concern growing in my heart for what I would find in the kitchen.
She still hasn't returned, said Linarala.
Irene broke in.
You gave her leave to visit her father for a few days, remember?
Oh, I said noncommittally. Let's see what we have. My newly adopted daughter led us into the kitchen, and the normalcy of the scene I found there made me immediately suspicious. I'd expected the place to be wrecked. Most new cooks make stupendous messes, but our kitchen appeared pristine. Perhaps she used magic to clean as she went, I thought. The food itself didn't seem frightening. Small chunks of meat were smothered by a thin brown gravy and accompanied by an assortment of root vegetables.
None of it is burned,
announced Linarala proudly. It looks edible, I murmured. She's already a step ahead of Rose if it isn't scorched.
Sit at the table, said the Shi'ar girl. I will bring plates.
A few minutes later, Irene and I were seated in the dining room with two plates in front of us. I glanced at Irene and gestured with my fork, indicating she should take a bite.
After you,
she told me with suppressed mirth in her features. I said nothing, but the daggers in my eyes conveyed my feeling, traitor. Fork in hand, I speared a small piece of meat and lifted it to my mouth. Surprisingly, it was tender, though the seasoning was entirely lacking. It could be eaten, though. I took another bite, but the texture made me wary, so I spit it back out and examined it. Of course it's tender. It's raw. The exterior had been lightly seared, but beyond that no further cooking had occurred. The meat needs to be cooked more, I said aloud. Then another thought came to me. Speaking of which, what kind of meat is this? I don't remember having anything other than eggs and salt pork on hand when I left the other day. Linarala made another attempt at a smile, botching it even worse than the first time.
I had to be resourceful. I hunted for this myself.
Oh, no. But what animal did it come from? I asked, fearful of the answer.
At first I thought I might capture a deer or some rabbits, but then I remembered Alyssa complaining that rats had gotten into the root cellar, so I decided to solve two problems at once,
Linarala said proudly. I dropped my fork and carried my cup of water to the outside door with me, where I began rinsing and spitting to clear every trace of her food from my mouth. That done, I returned and began a careful lecture regarding which animals humans consider appropriate for eating. I didn't bother showing disgust or being dramatic, for it wouldn't have done anything to reinforce my words. The Shi'ar could be very literal, often comically so, but they were excellent listeners, So long as I spelled out in great detail what was and wasn't for eating, she would remember. After I'd finished that, I moved on to lesser matters. Do you know where the salt is?
Isn't that just for preserving meat? She asked.
I sighed. Tell you what, tomorrow morning I will teach you to cook. In the past, we'd had almost half our meals in the main hall of the castle, but until the keep was finished, that was no longer an option. Penny had done a lot of our cooking at home, but while I didn't brag, I was probably the best cook in the family. Matthew and Moira were pretty well versed in the subject as well, while Irene and Connell were ignorant of everything other than knowing how to peel vegetables and wash dishes. In the weeks since my wife's death, however, none of us had felt up to taking on the task. Alyssa had done most of it when any of us bothered to show up. I gathered up the food and discarded all of it. Then I made a simple dish of carrots and turnips. There wasn't much, but there wasn't much to work with. It settled our stomachs, at least. The next morning found Linarana and me in the kitchen together. She was meticulous in her movements, which I took as a good sign. I doubted she would ever be very creative, but attention to detail was important in cooking. Even if she didn't become a great chef, she could definitely become a proficient cook. It was almost comical how serious her face was when she put on the apron. But before we went any further, I stopped her. You need to tie your hair back as well. You got food in it yesterday. She nodded and then pointed at me.
Where is your apron?
I rarely wore one. I had a reputation for getting food all over my clothing while eating, but for some reason I had much better luck while cooking. I won't need one. I'm here to teach. You'll do everything. Now, pay attention. I pointed to an object on the counter. This is the salt mill. Salt is the most important seasoning when you cook. Too little and your food will be bland, too much and it may not even be edible.
Will it be required for eggs?
Definitely, I told her. Eggs can be served without it, and they're still decent, but a little salt will make them shine.
Does everything need salt? She asked intently.
Damn near it, I answered. Even salad benefits from a tiny bit of salt right before you serve it. But let's focus on breakfast for now. Breakfast went well, and Karen even managed to coax Matthew into joining us for Linarala's first exhibition of her new skills. As I sat at the table, Irene, Linarala, and Karen filled the room with light conversation, and for the first time in weeks, the house didn't feel quite as empty. Matthew glanced at me at one point, and as our eyes met, I could see a similar feeling in his features. Maybe we could survive this. Then Sir Harold showed up, entering the room from the hall that led to the portal to Albemarle. He looked almost apologetic, but then he straightened and said in a formal voice,
"Your Excellency, forgive the intrusion. Queen Ariadne requires your presence."
I found the entire performance irritating. I hadn't built the portal to the Queen's chambers so she could send messengers to drag me out on a whim.
"Tell her I'll stop by this afternoon," I responded. "My lord, I'm afraid that isn't a request. She demands you attend her forthwith."
Forthwith? I doubted Harold had ever used the word before Dorian had found him, seen his potential, and decided to train him. They'd come a long way. That thought did nothing to keep me from being ticked off at the demand. What was Ariadne thinking? I shoveled another egg into my mouth and stood.
"Very well, I am ever the loyal servant."
Crossing over, I began to lead him toward the portal. Harold looked uncomfortable.
"You might want to change your attire, my lord."
I shook my head. "Of course not. If the Queen needs me, it must be urgent. Who am I to delay for such a trivial matter?" Irene caught my elbow.
"I'd like to come too."
I gave her a curious stare. "I don't mind, but why?"
"I haven't seen Carissa in a while."
Carissa Thornbear, Lady Rose's daughter, was Irene's closest friend, and the two of them hadn't seen each other since Penny's funeral. I simply nodded. One nice thing about the portal was that it led directly into the Queen of Lothian's private chambers, which meant I would likely get to see her privately before being dragged into whatever dog and pony show was planned for me. I wasn't disappointed. She was waiting for me in the front sitting room.
"Mordecai,"
she said as I entered. Harold quickly bowed and led Irene from the room, leaving us alone.
"Your Majesty," I responded, taking a knee. "You wish to see me?"
"Get up," she commanded. "It's just the two of us. You know better than that."
I kept my eyes on the floor. "As your humble servant, it is always wise to show deference," I replied.
How else should I answer such an urgent summons?
Damn it, Mort, get up and talk to me. I don't have long before the council meeting. I need to know what's happening.
Relenting, I stood, and following her direction, took a seat. I've already told you what happened.
There are a lot of rumors about the day of the attack on Albemarle,
said Ariadne. I shrugged. I'm not particularly worried about my reputation. The Queen looked irritated.
And what of mine? Do you think a monarch need not worry about such things? Lancaster rule was founded in large upon your support. How well do you think it will last if the nobility rebel against me?
Whatever they think of me, Harry, my actions are not yours.
We're cousins, she snapped. Over the years, they've held their tongues because of that fact, but recent events are too much. The close ties between our families are no secret. If we cannot find some reasonable answer to these rumors, I may not be able to shield you.
I'm perfectly fine being a scapegoat, I said angrily. I've done it before. I still have the scars to prove it. If there's that much pressure on you, take my title. Give it to my son. Then they won't be able to accuse you of shielding me for your own purposes.
That isn't the point, Mort. You've been through enough. I know you're in pain. Losing Penny hurt all of us. I couldn't do that to you. And even if I could, cutting my own legs out from under me wouldn't strengthen my position,
she said sadly. Frustrated, I asked, then what do you want from me?
First, give me the full story. I need to know exactly what you did and why. If I know that, I can at least give the reasoning and pretend I had some strategy, even if things didn't go entirely as planned.
She was right. I couldn't argue against her point. So, I gave her a detailed explanation without leaving out anything. When I finished, she sat still, a pensive look on her face.
So, in the middle of the night, as soon as you learned their location, you went to destroy one of these nests and sent your children to eliminate the other. You didn't even give it a day's thought or consideration.
Well, when you say it like that, it sounds stupid, I thought. I nodded.
You didn't expect the sort of reprisals we saw.
I did send Connell here, Harry, and I gave dragons to your knights. It isn't as though I didn't expect something to happen. I just didn't realize how strong the response would be, I said defensively.
How many dragons are there?
I hesitated. I plan to bestow another 7 or 8, once Harold gives me his list of candidates. Ariadne's eyes narrowed.
That isn't what I asked.
More than 10, I told her.
How many?
Listen, Ariadne, I've never shared that information with anyone. I think it's important to keep our enemies guessing.
I'm not your enemy, Mordecai. I'm your cousin. Don't you think I should know?
She said with calm resolve. Not necessarily. No, I said flatly. The dragons were my creation, created with the power I took from the gods with my own two hands. They belong to me. I decide who they go to.
Mordecai,
she said, her voice taking on a dangerous tone.
I'm your queen. I shouldn't have to remind you that you hold your lands in service to me, to Lothian.
The land, yes, I answered. But the dragons are mine. They were not granted to me. I made them.
And if I command you to give them up?
She asked coldly. There was steel in my voice. I wouldn't recommend you take such a course, Your Majesty. After a second, I added, Why this sudden paranoia about the dragons? You've never pushed the issue before. Her eyes bored into me. But then she relaxed, letting the tension flow from her shoulders as she exhaled.
From what you've just told me, I can make the claim that I authorized your actions. But while that will remove the blame from your shoulders, it will make me look somewhat foolish. I need to show the lords that I have a plan for Lothian's defense. The dragons make an excellent case in that regard, but I can't even answer basic questions about them. How can I admit that I don't even know how many there are?
I remained silent, thinking. Finally, I said, Tell them there are at least 10, but that you won't say more on the subject. Let them think you're keeping it a secret. Ariadne rose from her seat.
Very well. We'll play it your way.
I gave her a grateful smile. Thanks, Harry. She nodded, and then hesitated a moment.
Have you discovered anything about Roland?
Roland was her brother, the Duke of Lancaster. I shook my head. Nothing yet, but I haven't given up. She pulled me to my feet, and then hugged me. That was a slightly awkward gesture, given that she was dressed in the robes of state and wore her crown. The attire wasn't really made for such things, and I had to be careful not to lose an eye on the spikes on her crown. Then she spoke softly into my shoulder.
I'm sorry about Penny. I know this hasn't been easy for you.
The Queen of Lothian pushed me away.
I have to face the council now. They've waited long enough.
I started to follow her, but she waved me away.
I can't take you in there looking like a peasant farmer. Go home. I can deal with this alone.
Harry.
Not another word. This is the least I can do. Take care of your family.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.